All right, welcome back to Artsy Fartsy Immigrants. I'm your host, Jordan, here in M94.5 Studios with Moritz. It's 2020, and there's no looking back. Today we have a great guest, a talented drummer, and a very kind gentleman, David Jr. Hello, and welcome back to Artsy Fartsy Immigrants. This is, Mo, you said this is episode 8?
It is episode 8, including our introduction.
Including the intro. So, man, 7 episodes down, at least 7 more to go before they kick us off the air.
Well, let's hope so.
Before someone says something a little too risque, we get kicked out of here.
But we could still kick it out in editing.
We could still just
But we won't do that.
No.
Last time you said on air, yeah, let's just cut that out, and I did not.
No, you didn't. I don't want anything edited here. Everything racist that David's going to say, I want to keep it in the show. You know, it's okay. How it is. So, hi, David Jr. or David Jr. What do you prefer? How do you say it?
You choose.
Well, if I'm going to butcher it as I do most American things.
Just say David Jr. then.
So, David Jr.
David Jr.
Well, where's number one, David Jr.? No, nice, man. So, yeah, guys, this is the first episode of 2020. How did you celebrate the new year?
Just in the mountains, really. You know, been to the mountains, been to the lakes, had a bit of snow just for a few days. And yeah.
In Germany?
In Germany, yeah.
Oh, gone nice.
To the Bavarian Alps, and it was beautiful.
Ah, that's good, man. Yeah, yeah, that's such a beautiful area. Like, Germany's a great country for the winter.
It is.
If you like being cold, if you like snow.
Well, you being from the swamps, right?
Yeah.
You got to adjust.
Oh boy.
Oh man.
Well, that's why we went to Italy for New Year.
Yeah.
It wasn't that much warmer. I think it was like, well, it was better. It was like 14 degrees.
That's all right.
That's all right. Yeah. That's okay.
As soon as you cross the Alps from the north, you know, temperature's going to rise for like 10 degrees immediately.
It's crazy. It's
fantastic.
But yeah, this region is really beautiful for that. So David is a good friend of mine. We've been musician friends for a couple of years now, and he's a very talented drummer.
Thank
and
you.
Songwriter as well, right?
I wouldn't like describe myself as a songwriter, but more like as a producer of tracks, maybe, you know, because songwriting is like a whole different kettle of fish, as they say.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. That's it. Well, do you play other instruments? I know you play it like, actually, I should ask you this first because I have a drummer friend who likes to make this very distinct difference.
Mm.
He says, I'm not a drummer, I'm a percussionist.
Oh, right, yeah.
So for you, is it more of a percussionary thing, or you're like, no, I'm a drummer and I can play percussion?
Yeah.
A drummer who plays percussion.
Yeah. I would describe myself as a drummer that plays percussion, but I didn't like, you know, learn how to play the percussion, but
that's something that came
naturally. I've played a lot of like cajon and like, you know, different percussion setups that I put together myself, like with like singer songwriters and stuff. Played, you know, like congas and all that sort of stuff on recordings, but yeah, like the core thing would be the drums, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
And where were you from originally, actually?
I was born in Bonn, Germany.
Bonn? I thought you were from Munich.
No, I'm not. No, I was born in Bonn, which used to be the capital of former West Germany, right? Although it's not a big city, but it used to be the capital. And yeah, that's where I was born. And
how long did you stay there?
Not very long. Only like the first like 5 years of my life. And then came to Munich. After that, went to Liverpool. I think we're going to talk about that later on.
And yeah. Then went, wait, slow down, yeah, slow yeah, down,
yeah.
Slow down.
So yeah, that's where I'm from. And
Bonn. Okay. Yeah. And when you moved to Munich when you were just a young kid?
Yeah. When I was a kid, right.
Okay. And what age did you start playing music, or when did you really get into music?
I did really get into music as a listener when I was about 11 or 12 years old.
Was it the dad?
It was like the classic thing of like, you know, my dad or my family, they're not like, they don't have this, like, you know, people always tell that story of, you know, my dad used to have this like huge record collection and stuff. It wasn't that, right? But there was a few records and I listened to them, and then I got hooked on stuff. The first thing was...
What was the first first band that got you?
There was two things very different. One was called Don't Worry, Be Happy by Bobby McFerrin.
That was one of the... really? That was one of the tracks.
Believe it or not.
Everyone
and
always,
the other one, the other one was like totally different. I think you don't know it, but it's an Austrian band called Opus. And they had a song called Life is Life, right? It's this huge stomper where it goes like, Life is Life, na 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 na, right? And there was a live recording
like
of
a big
that,
stadium
like
track.
A big stadium, like singing the song.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I was totally, hooked by that when I was 12.
My dad was also...
Or 11 or something.
My dad was also not the guy who had like this big record collection, but I would say he's definitely... It was funny, a funny balance between him and my brother. My brother's 4 years older than me, and my dad, I would ride in the truck with him, and from his side, he was feeding me, like, of course, Led Zeppelin and Queen, and but then from that, I got myself into, like, Pink Floyd and some Bob Dylan and, like, Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young and stuff. And then what's funny is I was so head over heels in love with this kind of music and really starting to tap into things like Black Sabbath, but then from my brother's side... He got me really into Britney Spears, Ooh. NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, Destiny's Child. Yeah, yeah, I mean, in 98 Degrees, I don't know if you remember that band, or like Smash Mouth, LFO.
No.
I was really into these cheesy mid-90s pop bands at the same time that I was like, this Britney Spears song is such a good hit. Now, next, I'm going to play the Lemon Song by Led Zeppelin. Yeah. So for me, I always had this rock.
I kind of left this, like, you know, left this phase like behind pretty quickly and went to the record stores. And back then it was pre-CD, believe it or not. So you went into the record store, LPs were gone and you had MCs, right? Cassettes. So we were always digging for cassettes. We didn't know what to dig for. So we were like choosing for like cool covers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you found stuff like, I don't know, mostly like metal and rock stuff, and that was the sort of stuff that I was into then. And then working it back from the metal and rock, going into like leaving the metal phase behind, working it back to the 80s, to the 70s rock, then getting into jazz, then listening to electronic music, then basically listening to everything later on. Yeah,
it's funny that you mentioned this, looking at the cool covers, because, you know, they always say not to judge a book by its cover, and that's, I think that's ostensibly true. But with a record, man, you're judging that cover so fucking hard.
Absolutely.
How many times have you walked through a record store and seen this fresh, super sexy, cool, alive cover, and you're like, I got to hear what that band sounds like.
Man, if you're a 12-year-old and you go to a music store and there's a like a Mötley Crüe cover or Appetite for Destruction of
Appetite
Guns N' Roses with the four skulls on it, and like you go like... It's the coolest thing I've ever seen, you know?
Oh, my God, absolutely. Yeah. I think one of the last really badass record covers I saw was, I think, from 2017 or something. Do you know Thundercat?
Yeah.
I think the record's called, is it called Drunk? Or that's the one. The cover is a guy rising out of a lake or out of a body of water, and the water is sort of at the rim of his top lip. So it just looks like this crazy half face coming out, and his eyes are really bloodshot, and he just looks like this crazy Friday the 13th sort of is it called Drunk, Mo?
Yes, it is called Drunk.
Yeah, that's a great record. That's a real, really strong cover, I thought.
Yeah, there's a saying that some one of my musicians friends used to say, that das Auge hört mit, so the
eyes hear with
It's the same with covers and on stage, right? It's got to look good.
I mean, there's nothing better, I think, than putting on a really strong record or CD from my generation and and like sitting back with the booklet, looking at all the artwork and reading the lyrics with it. I mean, when Third Eye Blind dropped, I think the record's called Blue, I was obsessed with this man. I was like, oh, she's 10 days late. What does that mean? And I was reading the lyrics like, oh.
You know, that's one of the very sad things about like the whole digital, you know.
Revolution or whatever
in music that you can't. Like I used to read like every fucking little note on the record, like who produced it, where was it produced, like who was the bass player, you know, and all that sort of stuff, reading the lyrics and
I would obsess over it.
Yeah, people don't do it anymore.
You'd read it so much that it didn't fit back in those little plastic corners anymore. But did you, when you were learning to, when did you learn to play drums? Because that's when you got really into music.
Yeah. And then it was about the same time when I was learning to play drums.
Like 11, 12?
Yeah. But then it was more like casual playing, like not really like.
Did you have a drum set at home?
I did.
Who got you that?
Yeah, my mom.
Yeah, nice.
It was the pots and pans story.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, classic.
I love that.
Absolute classic, yeah. She was like, hey, maybe you should take drum lessons. And I was like, no, I'm not going to school, to another school, like music school, after I've been to school. I'm not doing it. She was like, yeah, maybe you want to try it out. And then I went to the local music school, and there was this great music teacher. Like I think that's one of the most important things when you start out playing music and you're young, like you have like that one person that really, you know, gets you hooked.
What you're trying
and he
to
he was an old
do.
Like metal rock dude. He was also playing keyboards, and basically what we did was just after a few lessons, like every lesson would just be, or every second would just be like him playing a tune like Van Halen's Jump or whatever on the keyboards, and me rocking out on drums. Mm. And that was fantastic. You know, you felt like, wow, you know, I can play these tunes, and it's like the best feeling in the world, you know?
Yeah, that's true. He also
got me into like the whole, he showed me a lot of records, you know, he had this, he was the guy that had the huge record collection that my dad didn't have, right?
Yeah.
So he showed me all these records and stuff, and yeah, that was great. So I started out when I was about 12 or 13, but I only got serious when I was about 17 or something, you know, I started to really practice the drums. And
how long did you work with this guy?
About till I was like 16 or something.
Oh, maybe. So you
like,
stayed with him until you
like 4 years, something like 4 years. And
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what happened at 17? You
I went to another drum school that was like a bit more like high profile, if you call it like that. Did that for about 1.5 years.
Was this where you were learning to read sheet music?
I'm actually not a very good reader of
music. I can't read music.
I can read like percussive stuff, but I can't read like, you know.
I was just curious if that was part of it, because I feel like if you're in a music school in Germany,
no, it was a drum school, right? So so you'd have to read all the drum notation, but it wouldn't be like chords or like stuff like that.
Do you think that reading drum notations is harder, less hard, or the same difficulty as standard sheet music?
I think it's less difficult. Yeah.
Less difficult.
Yeah.
For me, it feels crazy to see like how can you write.
Maybe it's just what you're used to, you know. If you're used to looking at, you know, proper sheet music or whatever you want to call it.
Could you explain it? Because I know a bit about it also from school, but I think most people don't know the difference between regular sheet music in a special key or whatever and written drum notes.
Yeah.
Yeah, drum notes is just like, basically there's just like an instrument on the drums. It may be a tom or the snare drum is assigned to a line, like you have the lines in the notation sheet.
So is it like
right?
Reading each beat in order that they're supposed to be hit?
Yeah, it is, but there could be multiple hits at the same time, of course, you know. So basically the top line would be your 8-note hi-hat or whatever.
And that's consistently throughout the song.
That's consistent, and then you have the psh, you know, on the 2 and 4s, and then you have the fills and the breaks and yeah.
I think I've never even looked at drum notations before.
Yeah, you shouldn't.
have you ever looked at any kind of sheet music, Jordan?
Yes, no. I have friends who can read music.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay, so around 17, you went to this school. And when was it, you know, how long was it before you transitioned into going to the UK? That's a big leap.
It was, yeah. It was another 6 years then.
Yeah. 6 years later.
Yeah, okay. 6 years later. I was working at a music store at the time, like selling studio equipment and drums and stuff. Mm-hmm. And got serious with playing drums, playing in bands and stuff. Mm-hmm. And one of my best mates, he was a bass player. fantastic bass player called Toby Fleischer, lives in Berlin these
Shout
days.
Shout out.
Yeah. Fantastic dude. And he was already in the UK, Liverpool, studying there. And we always did like, you know, different projects together. And but then we weren't living in the same city anymore. So I was like,
fuck
dude,
that.
Dude, you know, we got to do a project in Liverpool, where he was based, right? Studying music. So I went over, we did a project called The Pool Conspiracy.
P-O-O-L?
Yes.
Nice.
Of course.
The Pool Conspiracy. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. We had an MC, some guy playing Rhodes, my mate Toby playing bass, and a guitar player. We did an EP there, played a few gigs around
In Liverpool?
Yeah,
around Liverpool. Okay, so you went straight there like at 20...
No, that was before, right? I was there, did the project, and we did the EP in a place called the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts, right, where he was studying. And they have, like, really good facilities for, like, recording and stuff. So we recorded the EP there, played the gigs. I went back to Germany.
How long was that? Like a summer?
Yeah, that was like, you know, a few weeks. I don't know, like maybe 3 weeks or something.
Okay.
And then, yeah, we had a great time. I got to know the place and stuff, and I was hooked, you know. I was like, okay, I want to do
taste.
It. Yeah, I got the taste. And I was like, I'm going to do it. And coming back to reading music, if you want to study music in Germany, I think nowadays there's a few, you know, like private schools and stuff. There's one in Mannheim. I don't know how it works in Mannheim and stuff. But like basically there's like two routes, right? You have you either go classical or you go like jazz conservatory, right?
Right.
So if you want to go to the conservatory, you have to like do an audition where you have to at least, if you're a drummer, play a second instrument to a certain degree, maybe a bit of piano playing, and you have to read music, right? If you don't, then you don't need to go there, right?
Yeah, they don't even
so
let you in the door.
I didn't play the piano or anything other than drums.
Right.
I couldn't read music properly. So I was like, okay, chances might be slim, right? So it was more like a kind of practical decision as well. And also, because I got to know the place and had the insights of what it takes to go through the audition, which was, there was lots of people auditioning and they only had like a few places.
For this Liverpool school?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, I had this band. We produced an album back then, a band called Trigger.
Nice name.
Yeah.
That's cool.
We had already produced an album, which I had written some brass parts and you know, just parts for it and did the drumming and blah, blah, blah. So I handed it in. And they were like, no, you're too late, you know. Auditions have ended last week.
Oh, shit,
really? I was like, oh, fuck, you know.
Oh, man.
But then I was like, you know, it was just on my mind, you know, I have to do this, you know. And then I applied a year later again.
Give yourself a year to work on it.
Got me into the audition, the stuff I handed in. I knew what was going to come. So I played a very good audition.
Nice.
And then they wrote me a letter going like, yeah, you know, your audition was great, but because they also do a music theory test and stuff. Ooh. That I miserably failed, you know. And I was like, oh shit, man, that's gonna be you know. But then they were cool about it, you know. They were like, yeah, basically they were saying like, we know you're shit in music theory, just work on it. It'll gonna be all right, you know. Just put a bit of work into it, and then, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
that's pretty chill.
Yeah.
And that was your kind of your acceptance into that school.
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And so then from that, did you tell your family you were gonna go over there? And how was that process? Like, were they super excited for you?
Kind of. Yeah. Yeah. Because I was. Of course, it's a big step, right? You know, and I've saved up some money and, you know, and I've also had a room sorted and everything. So I was
okay. Yeah, you had all that taken care of before you went over there.
I was cool to go over, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, packed a few boxes and a small drum kit and shipped it over, right?
Man, were you scared? Like, I guess you only had one or two friends over there, right?
Yeah. No, I wasn't
scared.
What
year was this around?
That was when I moved over. It's 2003.
2003.
Yeah, that's a long time ago.
Man, that's cool though. Yeah. That's a big leap to do when you're that young.
I know. And the funny thing is, I was just thinking about it today. Mm-hmm. Thinking about, you know, the podcast, because it's being an immigrant, right? Or being in a foreign country.
Well, yeah, just the process of
living. The thing is, when I was accepted, right, I wasn't sure how I was going to deal with the whole tuition fees, right?
They were
like way lower than they are today. Because back then it was like when you were from the UK or an EU student,
right,
you would have to pay, I think it was about £1,500 a year. Which is, compared to these days,
that's it?
Nothing, right? That's it, okay? But even those 1,500, mm-hmm. For me, it was like, 1,500, okay. So, but my mate, he made me aware of that thing called the Department for Education and Skills. And basically, it was great. And I'm really thankful for the great United Kingdom. Because they have this thing where you, when you have been supporting yourself, mm-hmm. As in work, for at least the 3 last years before you started your studies, so before you have been, before you can go to university if you pass the audition, right?
Yeah.
They will go like, okay, we're not going to take like your parents' money or what they earn into account, but we're going to take what you have earned into account in the last 3 years. And if we think that's not enough to cover the tuition fees, we'll pay it.
What?
Yeah, it was fantastic. So
that's like a miracle with
having in mind, you know, the whole UK going out of the EU thing, mm-hmm. and stuff. I was very, very lucky, and I couldn't be aware of this, like back in the day, that it was a very, very short period of time, like historically, right. That things like that could happen, you know?
Yeah, that's
as a German guy going over to the UK,
yeah,
and basically UK government, Department for Education and Skills going like, hey, you've been accepted at an art school in our country. We're going to pay your tuition fees, right? Fantastic.
Jesus, man. That's like, it's making me and Mo cry over here.
But do you have to pay it back, like, or
no.
A part of it? Like,
no, it wasn't
system?
A loan. Okay. It wasn't a loan. It was, they've been assessing what I've earned, like working in a music shop back in Germany. And they're going like, okay, fact is, you know, you have been accepted by this art school.
Yeah.
So just send us all your income material over the last 3 years. And then there's a sum underneath that, and they're going like, okay, it's not enough, you know.
So did they end up cutting it by like a third or something?
No, they paid everything.
They paid everything.
Yeah, I didn't pay it, and I wasn't even because
David.
It was, yeah, I know, it was fantastic. It was fantastic. I didn't tell anyone that was out of the that wasn't from the UK or or the EU, like Americans. They paid like $10,000
a year.
They
would have killed you.
I know.
Oh man, that's so wild. Oh, but I'm really happy for you that it worked out that way.
It
That's
was fantastic.
A miracle.
It was fantastic.
And how many years did you go to school there?
3 years.
Is it 3 year school or your program was 3 years? Or is
it's
it the
a,
same you, thing?
A regular, like a bachelor's degree thing. I think it always runs
okay.
3 years.
So give me like a like rundown for us. You know, you're living in Liverpool now, just got all this stuff settled with finances. You got a room set up, you got a couple of buddies there you play music with. And it's your first month going to Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts, right?
Yeah,
LIPA?
That's right, LIPA, yeah.
So let's say it's your first month at LIPA. What's the vibe? What's the style like? Big impressions, you know?
Well, being a performing arts school, there's like a lot of different things you can study, like a lot of different routes. Like you can study acting, there's a, like a management course, there's like a sound technicians, there's the music course, there's a community arts, you know, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's it's like a melting
pot. So you had the choice at the beginning for any of these paths?
No,
you got there for drums.
I was applying for music, for the music course, and the instrument was drums, right?
So, okay.
But within the music department, you could have like production, songwriting, composition, different like modules or whatever they called it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but being like, you know, a broader performing arts school, like the best thing about it was like, you know, different people coming together from different angles, you know, the managers and the sound technicians and the music, the musicians.
Must be like a cesspool of connections.
Absolutely. You know, that was the best thing about it. And like connecting with people and like, at the end, it wasn't that much about the tuition itself. It was more about, you know, like meeting people, being creative, forming bands and doing like whatever, playing music for a dance show.
Right.
Next day you'd go into the studio, record something for your mate.
Were you just going out and getting drinks with these new classmates like a few nights a week and making vibes, making connections?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You bet.
Let's get a pint at the pub. It's time to party.
One? Yeah. No, the good thing for me was that my mate that brought me over that I was talking about before, my mate Toby,
mm-hmm.
He had left by the time I went there.
No, no. Okay.
So, and I was taking over his room in a shared flat.
So that's how you got the place to stay.
That's right. Okay. So, and that was perfect because there wasn't like only, there wasn't any people living there that were studying in the place. It was all like different people, but they were like musicians. Not all of them, but like a lot of them.
But they weren't connected to the school.
That's
the same
right.
Way.
Yeah. So that got me a foot into like, say like real world, Liverpool as well.
What was that like?
Yeah, great. Cause like a lot of people tend to, if they're from a foreign country, you know, at least the first 1 or 2 years or whatever, they tend to be in a bubble. Mm-hmm. Of their own community, if there is one, you know, there was a lot of Scandinavians, you know, of course they would like, you know, it's not a bad thing, right?
No.
So yeah, I was living with those people and was a bit like far out, like not like close to the uni.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, getting the vibes there and you know, there was the crazy people hanging around, like playing flamenco music, you know. Crazy dudes.
Sounds like it was just
Scottish,
really alive.
Scottish dudes playing flamenco guitar like obsessively, you know, coming over. I was living with a tabla player and he was like...
What's tabla?
Tabla is this Indian percussion instrument. You know, boom, boom,
boom, boom. Oh, that's a really good impression of that. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and they do this thing where like, I don't know what they call it. It's like this... If you want to be a proper tabla player, right, or if you're a tabla player, you gotta hide yourself away, like once a year or every 2 years for like 2 months, right, and just practice.
Really.
And do nothing else except for sleep, eat, practice, right? And he did that. Like, all my nights were spent with from next door. You know, it was crazy. But we had a lot of jam sessions and stuff, and then starting to play with the local people there, you know, mm-hmm. people that was at uni or not, but most of them were, of course,
mm-hmm.
Playing with singer-songwriters and stuff, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It sounds like a really, like, that's, a strong vibe and easy to make some friends and...
Absolutely. I mean, basically, it's like when you throw a couple of hundred young people into one building...
And they all do music and film.
It's like a creative explosion, basically, yeah. Kind of, you could describe it like that, yeah.
In that time frame.
Because that's like what you want to do, right? You want to just
Yeah, you want to explore
it, you know, and everybody's like kind of on fire.
And, that's a really good expression for it. Yeah. Everyone's kind of on fire.
Yeah, and then you end up like, I don't know, not sleeping very much and just playing music all the time. And maybe have, you know, I've always had that, like the odd couple of jobs on the side, but you can just concentrate on like doing music like all the time, which is great. And you meet like loads of people. And and Liverpool is famous for a good music scene, right? And it does have a strong music scene and community. So you can meet loads of people there and play. Yeah.
You know, since I've known you, at least, I always thought that your English was really good. And
thank
I
you.
And I wondered if you had some insecurities or some hurdles to overcome speaking only English.
Absolutely.
At that time.
Yeah.
What was that like? Having it all around you, different accents.
That's the thing. Like, you know, Scouse accent, for example, is very strong. Very, very strong, right? So, like, the advantage you have as a German guy is like you would be listening in your childhood or your teens. If you're a music listener and you're a music lover, you would be listening to loads of music. So you're like, your ear is trained to the English language. Plus you will have it at school for a few years. So you think you can, you know, talk a bit of English or whatever.
Yeah.
But then you come over and
it's like
and you're surrounded by Scousers, right? And you're like, okay, I don't get a word they're saying, right? So on the other hand, like, for example, Scandinavian people, because they don't have this thing where everything's dubbed on TV, they grow up, everything they watch on TV and stuff is like English because it's not dubbed, right?
Right.
So their English is a lot better.
Yeah, it's really good.
Than
yeah.
like a German person's English would be at an early age, right? So yeah, but then I got over that, and I think the first night where I was like, okay, now I got it. I don't know how long it took. It was like probably a year, or I was in the pub. You know, it was late.
Few beers in, and some
Scouse guys like, and it's very noisy, and some Scouse guys like barking things at me, you know, like going like, yeah, you know, mate, and you know, oh, that's that. And I got every word he was saying, so
oh,
I was like,
man.
Okay, now I got it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've trained my ear to the Scouse bark, barking.
Like, I am finally one of them.
Yeah.
But for me, it's crazy to imagine people who migrate to any country and they end up going to a location of that country where the accents or the dialects are so thick. I mean, imagine if I had migrated here from America, but not to Munich or to a major city, but somewhere in the south or in like a small town where there's like Allgäuerisch or something.
Tough.
Like, just a totally... Or if people here only spoke Bayerisch, like this Bavarian dialect as opposed to High German. For me, if everyone only spoke that, I don't know.
Yeah, but you know what? Survive. Like language is like I found is key. You know, like in terms of when you kind of, I don't know, when you're living in another country, you will have to get the language right.
Yeah, for sure. I'm still taking lessons.
It depends, like, you know, it depends on the level you'll get it, but like you can't connect to a culture if you don't speak the language,
right?
Which will alienate you from that culture you're in,
right?
Like, you know, in time, like before if you're in a place for 10 years and you don't speak the language, then in my mind, you can go to some other place. You know?
Yeah, 10 years is 10 years is a big stretch to not learn anything.
You know,
of it.
There's people living in countries that don't like, because language is like, if you try to learn a language like from another country, it's like it shows that you're interested in the culture, right?
Right.
And there's a lot of cultural codes or things that you only understand about a country if you...
Once
if
you've got the language.
Yeah,
that's true.
In my mind, right?
Yeah.
So...
That's a good perspective on that, I think.
Yeah.
It's kind of a sign of respect, and it's effort of trying to acclimate yourself to your surrounding. It's easier on you the more that if there's things announced, like when I did my last German test, some of the questions on the exam were... they would play clips of like a train station. And they would say, okay, this, you know, train X is leaving from which station at what time? Is there any issue with it? And you'd have to hear this CD play this thing. They'd play it twice.
Yeah.
And you have to be like, ah, okay, aha. You would hear people walking by and like, mommy, mommy. And like someone drops a glass bottle, but you have to hear this voice being like, you know, attention, train X will be leaving from Gleis 5 at whatever time. But there's a 15-minute delay. And it's like, you know, if I hadn't spent any time thinking about that or being in the scenario, I would be totally lost.
Yeah, also it's a lot easier if you learn a language when there's no other language to fall back on, right? If you're a German guy in England, like nobody will talk any German to you. So
that's it, yeah. If no one spoke any English here, it'd be a different game.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really true.
So, but yeah, then I think German is probably more difficult to learn than English, or I don't know.
I would say it is. So when you were in the UK for these 3 years, were you on the road a lot? Were you getting into bands and expanding in your style?
I wasn't on the road too much. It was mostly playing in and around the northwest, kind of, yeah. Of course, there was like the occasional trips down to London, playing in London. You know, we did things like where sometimes you would go to London, play a gig in London, then go home the same night, right? Because couldn't afford a hotel or had to do another gig on the next day or something.
Oh, yeah.
And then just mainly playing around the north, and did one tour of Spain at the time, playing in Germany, of course.
Right. Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. I did want to ask you if you have a good story or a good feeling about the difference between doing gigs in the UK as opposed to doing gigs in Germany.
Well, talking about the north. Or probably generally in the UK, I feel like there's a lot of opportunities that you don't have here, but vice versa, it's kind of the same.
In which way?
Basically, like, you know, stuff like residencies, you know, there would be residencies in Liverpool. You could, if you have a band, you know, the club owner would go like, hey, you want to play like every, you know, every Thursday, every Friday, for the next 2 months or whatever. If the night wouldn't be going well, then they would skip the residency. But, you know, I never came across that much of residencies here.
In Germany.
You know, yeah.
I don't see it that often. We have that a lot in New Orleans as well. There's a few jazz acts that like hold down certain spots every week.
And in Liverpool, it was like, you know, there was always like four or five bands on at one night, which makes it very difficult to make any money because usually it's on the door. And when there's five bands on with like four people in them, then there's nothing left to get paid out. Like, and in terms of like playing, I think, like the English mentality, like versus the German mentality.
What's that like?
Like the music mentality is very, very different, because the English mentality to me is like they're very like creative. You know, they kind of honor the fact that you got the balls to step on stage and do something. Yeah? Mm-hmm. If you don't do it that well, then they'd still appreciate it, you know. And here it would be like, oh man, he can't do shit, you know, what's he doing up there?
Yeah.
You know, and so that's very cool, and that takes away like the fear factor. And if the fear factor is like reduced, it gives room for experimentation and like, you know, creativeness, right?
Yeah.
People come up with stuff that they wouldn't come up
100%.
Yeah, you know.
As soon as you break down that wall.
Yeah, yeah. Just go on stage and do it, you know. And the vibe, you know, the vibe counts. Like, but there's also like this thing of understatement in like the English mentality, which is like, you know, they want to make you believe that, you know, I just picked up the guitar last week, right?
Oh, yeah. But,
In truth, they didn't, right?
They don't want to seem like they've been practicing.
But maybe
that's
very different to the American mentality as well, because the Americans, I think, maybe American and German mentality is similar in that way, where it's like show off and be like very good, technically very good player or whatever, you know, is something that is appreciated.
That always turned me off from a lot of jazz guests.
In England, it isn't that much, I feel, you know. It's more about the vibe and about like understatement and going like, you know, you don't want to see all the work. You don't want people to see all the work that you put in, right?
That's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. But it's very, very creative. And also, like, you go to pubs and there would be people playing just with an acoustic guitar. Mm-hmm. And they'd be fantastic, right? You go like, this guy's amazing. I think that comes from the whole upbringing of maybe English people and American people as well, where you have like things like the American songbook, or like, you know, the whole history of like folk songs in England, where you would grow up playing guitar or playing the fiddle. Nobody plays the fiddle here. If you play the fiddle, it's classical violin.
Right.
And then in that way, you learn all the tunes, you learn like the craft of like songwriting, you learn it a lot more. You learn it a lot easier than, because it's in your blood, right? It's like folk music.
Yeah.
Like folk music in Germany is
a little bit different. Know,
yeah. So it's not something that you kind of soak from the mother's, as your mother's milk, right? So maybe that's why there's so many good songwriters in America and the UK.
That's actually a really good question. If the perspective or the culture maybe has an influence on
absolutely,
that sort of thing.
Totally. But coming back to your question, it seemed like for like bands in England, as soon as they have like a certain status or whatever, and they're trying to move out of England touring, for example, like Germany would always be the first choice to go, like the first country if you
want to
like,
come here
for a lot of, because it's not that far away,
right.
It's a big country. You have, compared to other countries, I think you have a lot of venues to play. Like every little town has their own venue, right? So you could easily string together, or not easily, but you can string together.
But you can do
it. Yeah, you can do. Yeah. You can do it. You can string together a tour of like 10 or 20 dates.
Yeah, absolutely.
Going out of your country, in this case, England. It's not too far away. Plus, like when it comes to like the whole way that venues are run and stuff, it's mostly pretty professional here, I think. You know, you go to the place, you get your catering and everything, like usually, and it's not like that always, you know, in the UK. I feel.
Plus,
maybe.
Plus, ever since the Beatles being in Hamburg, Germans just love British bands.
Absolutely.
Do you know the Subways?
Everybody loves British bands.
The Subways, yeah, I've heard of them.
On their second or third album, they re-recorded their single on it and sang the hook in German. They released it worldwide.
Ah, really? That was the Subways.
Yeah.
That's why I know them.
The one that did the Rummenigge Sexy Knees thing?
We just had
the football book before.
their biggest hit was Rock and Roll Queen.
Rock and Roll Queen.
Be my little rock and roll queen.
Oh, yeah.
Guess you know it.
I hope it's like that. But that's a good point, too, because, you know, you just talked about how you can book a lot of small towns and stuff here. And, like, when in 2016, I did a self-booked, like, small club tour throughout Germany. And the hospitality and the manners and the professionality of all the venues and the promoters and stuff was such a level up from all the places I'd ever played in New Orleans. You know, like, you can play a lot in New Orleans. You have these residencies. You have this mentality you talked about. But you don't have this, like, you're not going to show up to a place and have decent catering, maybe have your own bathroom, have like a little backstage spot.
Yeah, you'd have a crate of beer to share between five bands, you know?
yeah, exactly. So that, for me, that was a big leg up. And I wondered, you know, gigging in the UK, if it's more on the American side of like, it's a bit dirtier, a bit grungier, a bit like DIY. Is
yeah,
it?
Probably. I don't know. Up to a certain level, it definitely is. But there's another thing that's different. Like, they used to be at the shows, like, there's a lot of people that go like, you know, hey, man, you know, your band's great. You guys need a manager, or can I do something for you? Or, you know, there's always seems to be like people hanging around that, that kind of want to do something for you or want to manage you or whatever, or promote you.
Are they legit, or is it like kind
of? Yeah. Sometimes they are, of course. Sometimes they're full of shit, of course, you know. Yeah. But like, but it doesn't happen that much here, you know.
I've never had anyone approach me in person.
I mean, you played a lot of gigs here, right? And you didn't have anyone approach you in person, like
in the UK, that wouldn't happen. No, my last manager was like a Facebook message and an email.
Yeah.
And then the recent one was like me contacting someone with email. Everything's just email or contact through some social media or something.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot more people that are like also like enthusiasts, right? Like, of course, there's the dark side of people like talking bullshit but
right.
At least you got the feeling that there's like, you know, something going on and people want to promote you and
it gives you a good buzz feeling. Yeah. You're like, you know, something we're doing is right, so yeah, let's keep this going.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's a precious feeling to have that.
It is. Like, yeah.
Oh, we're doing yeah, it right. This is okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I love that feeling when you get to that certain spot with the band and you get that little bit of attention. Either someone wants the song for something, or you get asked in person about, you know, next time you're playing or whatever it is, and you're kind of like, all right, this is not bad. Yeah. This is the right thing to do. Yeah, this is the right way. We're doing okay. I love that.
Yeah, there's a lot of differences in playing here and there.
Do you have some good, because I know that you've traveled a lot for music. You said you'd played a lot in the UK and in Germany, I know for sure, in Spain and France. And do you have any, you don't have to name names, but any really crazy road stories? Because I feel like drummers and rock bands always have the best road stories. And I know you have one, I think, from France, which is pretty cool.
Which one?
or maybe it wasn't in France. But you had a crazy experience, like at a wedding gig, I think, with some mutual friends, or you.
Oh, there was quite a few wedding gigs I've played, like function bands and stuff.
Those are always really crazy. Those can either be super professional or super crazy.
Yeah, there was like guys falling into our backline and stuff. Oh, that's really? Another difference. I just came across that in the UK, mm-hmm, small clubs have backlines, right?
Really?
Yeah. There's a drum kit at the club, right? Everybody can play on it.
Oh, that's...
It's just a beaten up drum kit in like small clubs. You'd never come across a club here that goes like, you know, guys, if you want to use our backline, the drum kit is crap, but you can use it, right? So
never.
Potentially, as a drummer, like being
show
used
up with your cymbals to, and the snare or something.
Being used to like dragging stuff around, you would go like, oh, great. You know, I don't have to carry my drums.
Oh, man.
So that's another, like, I came across multiple clubs that have like drum kits, you know, and you go, okay, it might not be the best drum kit, but then they have like in-house engineers that are sometimes really good,
yeah,
that are like tuned to the drum kit, you know, yeah, they kind of know it. And so they'll get a kind of good drum sound anyway.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. There's a couple of venues in New Orleans that have that, but it's not that common. It's really not that common. And I never saw it in Germany at all.
Yeah. But talking about France, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. I played a tour where we were doing busking, right, in the south of France.
Mm-hmm.
3 or 4 weeks, we went down the south of France, like the Côte d'Azur.
Mm-hmm.
And
beautiful area.
Yeah. There was a few funny stories, like people throwing all sorts of stuff into the hat.
Yeah.
You know?
Like what?
At the beginning, we weren't aware of, like, because we weren't moving around. We mm-hmm were like stationed at the harbor or something with the drum kit, and we had car batteries for the amps.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay.
And then, of course, you'd have to load these car batteries from time to time, and then there would be a few nice girls, you know, like language students or whatever.
Oh.
So we'd have to go around the flat and recharge the batteries. We did.
Is that what you called it?
Yeah. So basically, but we didn't know how to make any money because we were playing, and then it was like, there was 100 people there, like, you know, and nobody was throwing any coins into the hat. And there was these three Danish guys, I think they were like, and they were making tons of money, like going around the cafes with their just their snare drum and their double bass.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're taking them aside, going like, hey, guys, how do you do it? How do you make money? And they were like, you know what? People here, they don't throw money into the hat. Like, you'll have to get the crowd, then the band will have to keep playing.
Extend some
then
money
the
around.
Singer will have to go around with the hat. Yeah.
Okay.
And our singer was like, no, I'm not doing it. You know, I'm not begging for money. And we're like,
come on,
you know,
you're going to do that
do
shit.
Do it. Yeah. And then we had like,
why not?
I don't know, 300 a night, you know, one night, and a couple of joints and stuff that people would throw in there and stuff like that. And yeah, then you sleep on the beach because it's too late to get in.
So, oh, that's yeah, nice though, kind of, right?
We had like this old van and... but yeah, if you want to go to a camping site or whatever, they close at 12, right? But yeah, that's when you're going strong, playing on the street. So
some people are
so we had to sleep on the beach a lot, and then being woken up by policemen at 7 a.m, like getting a kick in the butt. Right, you can't sleep here, you know? Fuck
oh,
off.
Oh man.
Yeah, just eating a lot of sandwiches and sausages, and yeah, and then got broken into or our car got the glass the windows got smashed in Paris when we were playing in the subway. It was terrible.
I want to ask
terrible about- to play there. And then we got back and yeah, our instruments were gone. The drums were there.
Oh, the drums were there. Thank God.
But the guitars were gone.
You were just smiling like, you poor guys. Yeah. Oh, I feel so bad for you.
Yeah.
I want to ask about this photo on your website with you and Rod Stewart. What was that about?
That was just a TV show.
A TV show with Rod Stewart.
No, it was a miming TV show.
They do that a lot in Germany, don't they? Like these playback.
That's another difference, right?
Yeah. Like, they don't do that in America.
No.
Or at least they do it well if we don't.
Yeah.
You know?
And in the UK, like it's actually really good to watch like late night shows or whatever, because there's always like really good live performances.
What's that really famous one where they have the band, circle of bands, and this one host?
Jules Holland.
Jules Holland,
fantastic.
Man.
Oh, what a show.
That opened me up, man. That was such
a
good show.
If you see this as a German person, like on BBC, which is the equivalent to the ID or ZDF, like first you go like, this is on fucking, you know, the state TV basically.
Yeah,
this is fantastic, right?
It's unbelievable.
I mean, and they had a festival in Liverpool back in the day where they copied it. Was just like a small festival, can't remember the name of the location, but they basically built four state. They do one in Munich as well. They did it in isn't it the Sound of Munich where they kind of tried to do the same thing?
That's the version we played that in 2017, I think. But that's a little bit different. It's kind of rushed.
Yeah.
You're sharing some stages, but
yeah,
the
Jules Holland
thing is so calm and open. And
it's fantastic.
I love that.
But yeah, I was registered with a company, like an agency, and sometimes you get an email going like, you know, you want to play a playback gig with someone. And Rod Stewart was a highlight, of course, you know.
Did you meet him?
Yeah, briefly, yeah. He's a huge Celtic Glasgow fan.
Really?
Right? Yeah, and Celtic Glasgow had played Barcelona in the Champions League soccer, right? Just the day before, and they won, which happens once in like 20 years. And Rod Stewart was seen crying on the stands of the stadium.
No way.
Like being, you know, absolutely out of his mind. And
so
the next day he had this Christmas miming show in Munich, like this Christmas TV thing, like
crazy.
A charity thing. He was drunk as fuck.
Really?
Absolutely.
Good. But
yeah, he was always only whispering, you know, my voice, you know. And I knew why, because I watched the match the day before, you know, and he was probably just screaming all the time, you know. So his voice was gone. And yeah, but he was obviously still very happy that Celtic had won. And he's a very, very cool guy. I've just seen him play live
few weeks ago.
Still got it?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome.
Very charming and fantastic voice, you know. I mean,
it's amazing after 50, 60 years. It's unbelievable. Ever since like The Faces, right? Wasn't that his first project?
It was, yeah. And yeah, his autobiography seems to be very entertaining though. Yeah.
I would like to read that.
Yeah, I'm sure it is very entertaining, yeah. And there's one story I recently read in an interview. He was asked about his hair, right? He's got the spiky
hair.
Yeah. And he goes like, you know, I couldn't afford the gel or whatever, the wax that he put in. But he wanted to have like a trademark.
Style.
Yeah. So in the early days, he used to put sugar into his hair and then stuck his head into a heated oven to let it dry.
No way. Just
keep, you know.
That's crazy.
It is. Yeah, but coming back to the to that agency, that was like a few miming gigs that I've done just to get some money.
Was
but it's not. I don't.
That's not like your passion, of course. No,
it's terrible.
But like, so you did this TV appearance with him, and then I saw also on your website that you've done some film contributions. Like, had you written some music that got into some films?
That was basically a friend that that I knew from back in the day in Liverpool, and he did a few tracks for films, and we did a few together. I was playing drums, and a few we wrote together. I think one or two we wrote together, and they were in films, movies.
They played in the cinema,
they were played in cinema. We were at the premiere.
Awesome,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, they ruined the mix.
Oh no! Really?
Yeah, it sounded.
Oh, so you weren't involved with the master?
No.
That sucks. Okay.
Yeah, but it sounded totally different in the cinema. Basically.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah.
I've seen that happen to too many good musicians.
But it was a very good experience anyway. And then over the years, you know, doing the coaching and the teaching and then getting into the production side a little bit, you know, now doing my own music, my own project. And
Just before I tap into, because I do want to talk about your record that came out last year a little bit. But just before I tap into that, I've got to ask how you ended up playing the Olympia Stadium in Munich, the Waldbühne in Berlin, the Commerzbank Arena, the Lübeck Pop Symphony. How did you play with these people in
basically,
these huge
places?
Everyone who's not German does are Waldbühne and Olympia Stadion are
these are the
maybe
two
the
biggest,
two biggest open air stages in Germany.
Open air stages, yeah, in the whole country. That's
well,
thank you.
Waldbühne isn't, because it's only like it's not a football stadium, but
it's humongous. I saw Neil Young there, and I was I cannot believe
it's
I'm
crazy. If
here.
you go on stage, because it used to be there's like swamps on the back of the stage, right? And then and we did like a support show for Celine Dion there, and it was an artist.
Right. Yeah, I knew you did that Celine Dion show.
Yeah.
Right.
It was an artist That's called crazy. John Mazek, and basically, that came through a connection from the Liverpool days. My good friend,
that's cool,
Luke Götze. He brought me into that project. I think, yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, and and you walk out. It's this very small, tunnel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very, very
compact and narrow,
claustrophobic, right?
Oh, really?
And then you get into this huge hall. With like the ceiling is like 10 meters
it's
high.
It's enormous,
right?
Man.
And then there's this huge door that goes onto the stage, and then the stands are like, they're like steep, like
yeah,
that,
yeah.
You know?
It's really tall.
It's crazy when you're on stage there.
It's like a wall of people.
Absolutely, yeah. And Olympiastadion was a bit of a circle, coming full circle, because I've seen one of my first big shows. The first big show I've seen was Guns N' Roses playing there in 92 or 93.
Nice.
So, and then playing there myself was really good. Although we were only like the support act and nobody paid like, you know, that
no, but
much
still
of attention
it's,
to us because you know,
the,
they were
it's
waiting
the,
for the
for it's the chance to do it, man.
For the big thing. Yeah, it was a very good experience, yeah.
And you and I even, we played together. We supported Elbow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was great.
Where
as well.
Was it in Switzerland?
Was,
not Zurich, but the capital?
No.
Wasn't the capital? It wasn't the capital?
No.
Was it Near It? Band? Band?
No, it wasn't.
Was it not?
No.
I'm dumb. I don't know.
Basel, maybe?
Basel, no.
Yeah, yeah, it was near Basel.
Near
right?
Basel.
Stimmen Festival, it was.
Stimmen Festival, yeah. That was a great festival.
It was,
man.
Yeah.
Beautiful crowd. Was it like 2,500 people or something?
Mm-hmm.
And
beautiful sound, nice sound.
Dude.
Great stage.
That's the most equipment I've ever seen a band take on stage.
There was a lot of equipment.
It was
on
a
stage.
Wall of Marshall amps, yeah. Huge kit.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, yeah, we're going to push everything back and you can use the stage. What's left of the stage?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's the way it goes.
But that was so nice, man.
Absolutely.
If anybody's looking for a good festival, Stimmen Festival, they were so supportive of us. You know,
absolutely.
They pushed the support.
And they've got
act's
a fantastic
name.
Lineup. I've just recently seen their lineup for. Was it this year or whatever? Like the festival they just had in 2019.
I guess they must have just had it, yeah.
Yeah, and the lineup was fantastic.
Great headlining artists,
yeah.
And they're so supportive of the opening act. I never see that.
Yeah,
and they really push the name.
But it was the same. Like it was the same on that tour with Celine Dion, because we didn't even have a tour manager and just went there with a bus driver and the band. And it wasn't kind of clear if we had to bring our own mics or whatever, or like, you
right.
know, in
yeah,
ears.
You never know.
And we were like, okay, maybe we're showing up and we're totally screwed, because everybody would go like, you're fucking amateurs, you know, you didn't bring anything, because it wasn't that clear, you know.
Right.
So
what happened?
Yeah, I remember, because Waldbühne was the first gig, I think. So I went into the production office, because like, okay, here we are. And and everybody was like, that nice, and they sorted
really?
Us out like 100%, you know.
Oh, I love
and
that.
It was crazy good feeling. Like
that goes a long way,
yeah,
man.
Absolutely,
it changes everything.
You go into the we went into the like backstage, and there was a bunch of flowers with a card from Celine Dion going like, hey, happy to see you here, guys, and have a good one and stuff.
Shit,
it was really nice. Yeah.
Well, that's cool. And you recorded and you released an album last year.
I did, yeah.
Called Digging and Release.
That's true.
And the artist's name is it?
It's my project.
The next
name,
little
yeah.
thing.
The next little thing. Right.
So how did you come up with the name of this artist?
I don't know. It's like name. It's the next big thing, right? But it's not. It's maybe because I've stringed so many projects onto each other
mm-hmm.
over the last years.
It has a really diverse sound. Every track is really
so I thought, like, in my mind it was like the next little thing that I was
like that.
Gonna do, you know. So
yeah.
Maybe there's a bit of understatement in it or whatever. And,
I think it's
and
kind
a
of cheeky
work,
like
work
a little
play,
like
bit cheeky maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just trying to get into the production side of things a bit more and produce my own music and played a lot of instruments myself.
Did you play everything on there?
Not everything, no. I have great guest musicians.
Because there's a lot of really cool sounds on
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah. I've played like a lot of bass, drums, percussion, keys, guitars. I picked up a guitar. I never played a guitar, but I picked one up, you know.
And you just, had never played one
no,
before? Oh,
but
wow.
But I picked one up and played a few lines and chords, you know.
Nice.
But then I have... that was also like one of the things I wanted to do with this project is like, you know, invite friends or people that I've crossed paths with over the last years
mm-hmm.
to be part of the thing, right? So,
who's some good Munich artists you got on there?
Yeah, there's a fantastic player called Florian Riedel on there. He plays fantastic.
Like woodwinds. And,
yeah, he plays everything, you know.
He's a super talented guy.
Yeah, plays a great solo on one of the tracks. And Reinhard Kreiner, fantastic trumpet player. Luke Götze plays some
super talented
acoustic guitars and some bass on one track, I think. And yeah, he does. And Knut Menzing, he's a fantastic guitar player plays a bit of guitar. And a good friend of mine called Yeti Hübner. She sings on one of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So basically...
So how long did it take you to get all the ideas together for it?
Oh, I think it was about 1.5 years or something.
Yeah. It's a big sound.
Yeah.
It's like a really explosive sound, a lot of layers.
Yeah.
And
yeah. It's like, it's influenced by all the stuff that I've listened to over the years, you know. Mm-hmm. You could hear some, maybe some George Benson on one of the tracks. You could hear some like the Blaxploitation kind of Shaft kind of sound.
Like the Chase is really.
Yeah, there's a bit of like early 2000s new jazz influence on it, like Kruder and Dorfmeister or Saint-Germain or stuff like that. Mm. It's a bit of like Massive Attack on one track in there. So the different influences and just trying to do a thing that is like 100% my own.
Where did you record it?
I recorded it in my studio space
here in Munich.
But some of the stuff I recorded at home, right? Yeah. But the drums in the studio space and at home, at a friend's place.
Nice.
Everywhere, really, like just taking the laptop, and that was one of the things I wanted to do as well, like keeping it like super low key, right? No big equipment, nothing, right? Just mm-hmm. the laptop and an interface and a few mics, nothing more.
Simple.
And a few instruments, you know, and then mixed it myself and gave it to a fantastic mastering engineer in Liverpool, the Loft Mastering, Mike Cave.
Oh, great.
And yeah, he mastered it and now it's there. And
excellent.
Yeah, I'm really happy that it's out.
Yeah, it's a beautiful record.
It's done, thank you.
It's really, really well done, really well crafted. And is there any, are there any new concerts with bands coming up or new releases or anything you want to push?
I'm working on like the second release at the moment, starting to get the chapter two going.
Excellent. Very cool.
Starting to get that going. And that'll be my main focus. Like, cause I kind of tapped into something and just want to expand the whole doing my own thing.
Absolutely. I just had one more question because it just popped in my mind. We were talking about differences between UK and Germany, especially for music related things, and before we started off mic we talked about rehearsal spaces, because my feelings about rehearsal spaces in Germany, or at least in Bavaria, is so negative, because I feel like they're shoving musicians very far away from the city, underground, dirty warehouses, everything's loud and cramped and cold. And how was it in Liverpool for rehearsal spaces?
Well, being at uni, you could rehearse there, right?
That's pretty dreamy, yeah.
But if you wouldn't be rehearsing there, it will usually be warehouses, mm-hmm. attics,
yeah.
But also the occasional flat, because when it's like a small acoustic setup, you know, somebody playing guitar, singer, songwriter, a bit of percussion, maybe double bass or whatever, and you know, it's not that loud.
Mm-hmm.
You could also like rehearse in flats and stuff.
Yeah.
But I feel it's the same anywhere, really. Like, I spent a few years living in Berlin as well, and it was kind of the same thing there as well. Like, just the inner cities is like, it's difficult. Plus, if you have a space, if you're someone renting out, you will, it'll be very expensive, because people tend to rip off musicians as well. Like, if I see like the amount of money that some rehearsal spaces get rented out for, if you break that down to the square meter, it's absolutely horrendous.
Really?
Like, for that price per square meter, you could rent a fucking loft. And what is it? Mostly it's just a shithole that somebody rents out for like 25 square meter or something.
People,
you know,
love to scam musicians, yeah, man.
It's crazy, you know. But they're also doing great things, like funding. Like, there's this thing going on in Munich where you can apply for funding for your rehearsal space,
mm-hmm.
which I think is great. They fund a lot of people. It would be even better to build new rehearsal spaces.
Yeah.
But Yeah,
that would be great. I think just build more.
Yeah, spaces. I think it's the same in any city. Really, I think it's difficult. Like rehearsal spaces where it's like loud and rock bands. You know,
yeah,
you don't want to have that as your neighbor if you know.
Yeah, that's kind of the curse of it in general.
Well, it's terrible. I've had an odyssey with being a drummer in rehearsal spaces. I've had so many and moving in and out of places and yeah, but
it's worth it. I mean,
yeah, you know, there always comes, you know, yeah. That if one place is gone, there comes another one, you know.
Yeah, wherever they push us,
yeah,
we'll be there.
Absolutely.
We'll keep fighting through it. Oh man. Well, David, I just want to end this great conversation. First, I want to say thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We're so glad that you were able to come by today and talk about your great music and your great stories with Celine Dion and Rod Stewart and Liverpool. And Mo, I just wanted to ask, what was the name of this game that we would do where they have the voice of God?
Grand Statement.
Grand Statement.
OMG.
It's going to make a lot more sense when we put some reverb on there. So I would like to end with grand statements. It's one of my favorite little things we do at the end. So you, you're God in heaven, and you have a chance to address the entire world at the same time with one profound message from the heavens. What's the one thing, one sentence that you say to the whole world?
Could be anything.
Can be anything.
Could be anything. Well, being an arty chat, I'd say create a piece of art today, even if it sucks.
Oh, very nice.
You like that one?
I like that one very much. That's really cool, man. Straight from the heart.
It's good, isn't
Well, David Jr., the next little thing, Digging and Release, available everywhere. Check it out. Great songs. And David, thanks for being here, man. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Jordan. And looking forward to listening to your next episode.
Absolutely, man. All right.
All right.
See you later.
Take care.
You got, baby, the saints are coming through. And it's all over now, baby blue.
Are you or someone that you know an artsy-fartsy immigrant and you think that they would sound great on this show? Well, please send an email to podcast@m945.de, podcast@m945.de, to submit yourself or your friend to the show. We'd love to have you.
Artsy-fartsy immigrants. Ein Podcast von Jordan Prince, produziert von Moritz Batscheider, für M94.5.